From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. For the past several years, we've been reporting on the rising multipolarity that seemed to burst onto the world stage in the form of various regional groupings like UNASUR and CELAC in the Western Hemisphere, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and other regional groupings in Asia, Africa, and Eurasia, and, in particular, the so-called BRICS group, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which appeared to be poised to present a global alternative to the U.S.-EU-led neoliberal model. We've also been covering the attempts by the U.S. in particular to smother this rising threat to its global hegemony with the start of a new Cold War against Russia, the so-called pivot to Asia aimed at China, the backing of anti-ANC political groupings and candidates in South Africa, and most recently, the signing of U.S.-India military cooperation agreements, the suspension of Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff earlier this month as yet another challenge to the BRICS, was the topic of this special interview with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international affairs at Moscow State University. We spoke with him from Moscow via Skype Sunday.
Since the new confirmed by WikiLeaks U.S. intelligence asset Temer has taken power in what many people are describing as a soft coup. China and Russia have both made very cautious statements saying they are looking for stability and the retention of long-term partnerships with Brazil. But I think it's pretty clear that certainly Rousseff has been completely outmaneuvered, but it has obviously been long in the works, and the U.S. has very successfully used the downturn in the Brazilian economy, commensurate with the downturn in the global economy and the reduced commodity prices that Brazil's economy depends on so much, reduced Chinese growth. They've exacerbated this into political dysfunction. A few years ago, Rousseff had some of the highest approval ratings of any world leader among the Brazilian people. And I've seen some polling numbers now that put her approval rating at about 10%.
Which is five times what Temer's is, by the way.
Yes, that is a very good point. I was going to exactly say that. I've seen that Temer's approval rating is 2%. Right. And he is of course, actually accused of personal corruption,
right,
rather than just filling holes in the state budget from the government bank, which other previous Brazilian presidents have done, which Rousseff is accused of doing, again, which many people say is absolutely no legal justification for an impeachment. And this is entirely a political impeachment. It's a reminder that in the BRICS, that the more liberal democratic nations have this weak point, and the U.S. Has effectively used it against them. In South Africa, we've also seen warnings from Zuma, increased increased loudness, increased worry that the U.S. is cooperating with his political opponents to try to overturn the African National Congress.
Yep.
While he has more political support than Rousseff, and I think the African National Congress's control is pretty firm in South Africa, Zuma's position at the top of the African National Congress may not be.
Right.
And that's where instability could certainly come in, and a more moderate leader of the African National Congress could certainly be in the cards in the next few years.
Yeah.
Someone who is more willing to be more neutral to Western interests than Zuma has been. And we've seen a turnaround in India that I find particularly worrying and disappointing, with Modi granting basing and other rights to the U.S., signing a few landmark deals allowing the U.S. to make use of Indian bases under certain conditions, of course, but also agreeing to cooperate with the U.S. in what essentially are anti-Chinese war games in the South China Sea,
right?
Which would seem to be very much against the spirit of BRICS. And the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of which India is set to become a full member, well on the path to, actually. So this is a big disappointment in Modi.
Yeah.
So I think what we're seeing is the BRICS is done.
Let me ask you, you know, China, it's difficult. I know they're playing a long game. And I know that, you know, as they make investments around the world, they have to look past regime change. If you enter into a 20-year agreement, you can't say, well, you know, it's only going to be performed under these political conditions or those. If you invest $20 billion, you want to make sure that after you make your investment, you get the return over the 20 years, regardless of what happens politically, domestically. But we see, on the one hand, they are throwing support, economic support, to Argentina, to Macri. They've said nice things about the new economic minister under Temer. And at the same time, they landed a naval task force at Cape Town last week. You know, they're playing like on all fronts.
Well, you know, they have to be, simply because, I mean, this is just, you know, high politics. They have to deal with the cards that they're dealt. And, of course, they would have preferred to see the previous governments or, you know, their political successors you know, take power. They have to do something to protect their interests and you know, their international relations. But you know, they certainly can't be happy about all of this. And there's I think both Russia and China are still waiting to see what will happen in Brazil, because, I mean, there is a real potential for civil instability, depending on what happens with this impeachment. I mean, civil war is still perhaps unlikely, but not out of the question. And, you know, that really wouldn't be good for them or for anyone.
Yeah.
But they know that the country has just essentially been geopolitically flipped. And I think we see the same thing in Argentina. Argentina, of course, many people were already starting to use the acronym BRICSA or some other tortured attempt because Argentina was growing so close to Russia in particular, but also, you know, to the other BRICS members. And, you know, there were talks, you know, very premature talks about Argentina joining, which have proven, you know, fruitless. But China has put a lot of money into Argentina and Brazil over the past few years, and China is by far, you know, Latin America's, you know, biggest trading partner now, particularly the countries Argentina and Brazil. So they have a balancing act to play.
So the overall, you know, we were looking at a rising multipolarity on the world stage. It seems to have taken, if not a fatal blow, certainly is wounded right now. What do you see?
Oh yeah. I mean, there was no question about the timing of this. We were seeing the BRICS Development Bank, you know, starting to become a reality. Other BRICS, international financial structures. We were starting to see just a few years ago the BRICS really start to look like they might have some wings, and all of a sudden those wings are clipped.
Yeah.
And you know, as should have been predicted, as was widely discussed, you know, the United States went for the, you know, the weak links in the BRICS chain, and Brazil was the weakest link. And, you know, South Africa's swift to follow, and India is now hedging its bets. It still has a very good military technical strategic partnership with Russia, but is obviously going back to balancing with China. The wings of BRICS are severely clipped. It is difficult to see what will turn this around. I mean, we could hope that a rising oil price will put more money in the Chinese coffers and help these struggling, economies in South America, but it may be too little too late at this point.
Yeah, and it may be even that, I mean, now say Temer is able to hold on to the reins, if not personally, for the right wing. Likewise, Macri and the opposition that controls the legislature in Venezuela and is on the offensive.
Yeah.
If, you know, the economic situation improves from the ground, it's going to look like they did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly it will now. That's a very good point. I think that they will get more of the credit because they are the ones that will now be in power on the ascendancy. We start to see oil prices creep up a little bit. Haven't seen any big macroeconomic numbers on the Chinese growth is reversing. You know, it's still growing at 7%, but that's right. Already a significant slowdown from what we saw, you know, over the past decade. And that may actually be in Chinese interests, but it's definitely not in the interests of countries like Brazil, Venezuela, and Argentina that you know, China has become so important to their economy. It's a bad situation. And then, I think the multipolar world, certainly the South American branch of it, has suffered a severe withering. And it's not easy to see how they can recover from this. So, again, because of the economic situation and their democratic systems, which make them more vulnerable to outside interference, the big problem is that there is significant popular discontent with Rousseff, with Kirchner, with the Bolivarian government in Venezuela and Maduro in particular, and you just can't get around that. Well, you've seen some terrible approval ratings, and you know, economics, you know, the personal wallet is a big part of that. And that's not to say that the opposite side will benefit, but as you pointed out, simply the change in the global growth and market dynamics, you know, so much depending on the price of oil, may give them the credit that they don't deserve.
You know, then looking at that, let's say that on the one hand, rising commodities prices help to alleviate some of the stresses on those economies. The orientation back to neoliberal economics means that there will be austerity imposed regardless, and that will those will be political legislative acts that do it. You're seeing Macri, you know, he went all out as soon as he took office before Congress even convened, and we see Temer doing the same thing. I mean,
privatization. It took a whole weekend for him to announce a big wave of privatizations. I was kind of surprised it took the entire weekend to see that.
Yeah, but I mean, he's an interim president. What he's supposed to be doing is administering on Rousseff's behalf, not replacing her cabinet and changing the direction in economic policy. But that's in fact what he's doing.
The interesting changes in her. Of course, she did fire her cabinet.
Well, yeah,
as soon as she was the impeachment was announced as kind of some retribution to allies who had turned their backs on her. Mm. We saw the culture ministry axed, the gender equality ministry axed.
Right.
We saw the racial equality ministry axed.
Right.
Anything that vaguely smacked of leftism was axed. Right. In the name, of course, of cost cutting.
There was an interesting pushback there too, because the first defense minister that was proposed or that was floated by Temer was rejected by the generals.
Yeah. But I wouldn't expect it to go much farther than that.
Right.
I mean, we're not going to see the Brazilian military step in on the side of Rousseff. In Venezuela, that's more of a possibility because the military has been more involved in the ideological aspects of the Bolivarian Revolution.
Right.
So there, it's a definite possibility. In Brazil, no. That's not going to happen. The Brazilian military will stay largely above it, aside from expressing some discontent at the first political appointee that Temer tried to appoint over them. And you know, it, in Brazil, which is a very multi racial country, we now see an all white, all elderly male
right. Yeah,
cabinet.
Right. I know.
By Temer.
Yeah.
So Yeah.
Argentina, likewise, the military most likely is not going to intervene on the behalf of the left.
No, I wouldn't see that at all.
I would say au contraire to that, if anything. But yeah, in both places, you have the legacy of military dictatorships and the ascendancy of the political class, essentially, that was in alliance with them and their political agents back in power.
Yeah. So what we saw in South Africa this past week was China's the 22nd Escort Task Group, which had been involved in anti-piracy activities in the Gulf of Aden, docked in South Africa. And of course, that's a sign of some political support, and also that China is stepping up its military shall we say,
presence.
Yeah, I wouldn't say ownership, but statesmanship.
Right.
They have a stake in Africa, you know, which China is Africa's biggest trading partner again, by a large stretch. I mean, we've seen China also put 8,000 peacekeepers under UN helmets in Africa in recent years, by far the largest. China's invested some $62 billion over the last decade in African governments with no political strings attached, something that's very popular. And we see a million Chinese workers in Africa. The Chinese big trade-off is you sell us commodities and we're not going to demand Washington consensus, neoliberal reform of your government and societies. And we're going to build you infrastructure to boot, because that will facilitate our access to your commodities and help stabilize your governments, which is in our interest. So it's largely been a win-win for the African countries. China has broken ground. They're well on the way to establishing their first military base in Africa. It's their first overseas military base proper at all, and this is in Djibouti, which is a very strategic place, again, around the Gulf of Aden there. It connects the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean, the Bab el Mandeb Strait there, and there's 30% of the world's trade that goes right through past there.
Right.
And it's very important for Chinese economy, for growing their economy. Having some control, some degree of protection for the trade, in particular the resources and commodities that China needs from Africa to keep its economic engine humming and keep producing consumer garbage to put in Americans in Western hands.
You know, when we're looking at BRICS with the potential of it evolving into this, true alternate, structure that it looked like for a moment it might be headed towards, geopolitically, one of the differences between that and the old Warsaw Pact, and even before that, Soviet and Chinese bloc, was that it was geographically placed on, you had South Africa in Africa, you had Brazil in Latin America, and then India, Russia, and China. And now as they peel that off, you're seeing a condition where China is still growing its economy, but in terms of the ability to, even the potential in the future, the ability to project military power, to coordinate military defense across that, is receded back to Russia and China. What are the implications there for this trade that's going to be going on while guns are pointed at the borders of Russia and China, and pressure for regime change will intensify, I'm sure, from the West in both places?
Well, I'm not so sure about the China's ability, growing ability, very slowly, to project military power, and we should be very cautious how we say that. I wouldn't say that that's so much receding, because although South Africa looks under stress, China still has good relations across Africa. And I mean, take a look at this military base in Djibouti. The government there has, which is one of the more stable governments in Africa. There's also military bases of the U.S. France and Japan in Djibouti.
Right.
In fact, the U.S. military base is within eavesdropping distance. And the government of Djibouti has says that China will have every right to fly drones and aircraft just like the Americans out of there. So that's not going to change. And I think that we'll see China taking more steps. And they've got, you know, multiple geopolitical angles for protection of their you know, their resource, the supply lines going here. You know, the Silk Road is a solid, more solid line because it's not vulnerable to U.S. naval attack, right? The heartland of Eurasia is largely outside of U.S.'s direct military intervention. And what they've been trying to do in Afghanistan has completely failed. In fact, the Taliban have more control of the country than they've had since 2001, perhaps even more control of the country than they did in 2001, actually. But they've also got their what is presumed to be discussed as a string of pearls strategy, where Djibouti will only be the first of several military bases from Africa to China. That will help protect this trade route, which of course will traipse across Indian dominated waters, the Indian Ocean. The China does have a satellite facility in Argentina, and they've been very careful to say that it has no military capability, but you know.
And then, of course, China still enjoys good relations with, well, they enjoy good relations nominally with everyone, but you still have Nicaragua and Cuba, the possibility for, you know, some sort of cooperation to, you know, as China, for example, develops a canal in Nicaragua, deep water ports in Cuba.
It's not a complete recession of Chinese, and China has deep pockets, and everyone knows that the future is China. So even when you see geopolitical shifts, everyone in South America and Africa are very careful not to step on China's toes because of how essential Chinese investment and Chinese purchasing of their commodities is for their economies. And things get far more interesting closer to home for China, because the U.S. is really trying to put the full court press. This whole Asian pivot is all about containment of China and the establishment of a cordon of nations aligned against China. And China has been very actively pushing against that. They have been very insistent. I mean, China has not been a naval power in many centuries. But China is very much aware that because they are such a global economic player, they need to become a naval power now. And they're pushing very hard on this, and the U.S. is very upset about this because China is, first and foremost, in the South China Sea, developing an anti-access area denial to the U.S. We saw in recent years the most recent upticks in tensions with Taiwan. And China, the U.S., within the last decade, put two carriers in between Taiwan and the Chinese coast. And China didn't like that very much. So they've made big stretches in modernizing the Chinese Navy. And the U.S. is extremely worried about this, particularly in subs and mine laying and the development of anti-ship missiles. Now, this is all about defense, but we've seen the Chinese naval defense moving from a passive theater defense, a territorial defense. We've seen that move to a trans-theater mobility, because in naval strategy, which is very much what China's whole grand strategy has to be positioned towards now, mobility is key. You keep all your forces bottled up in one place and they're just targets. So mobility is key. We've seen moving from an offshore waters defense to open seas protection, it's called in military terminology. A territorial seas protection to an air offense and defense with intention to build a blue water navy. Which allows for power projection. So China is really upping the game here, but they're under significant pressure because they are running into political problems with Vietnam, with the Philippines, with Japan, with Taiwan, of course, with Malaysia, with Indonesia, all of Indonesia, and possibly even with India, as the U.S. tries to herd and rope all these countries into this anti-Chinese containment alliance, and it's all coming down in the South China Sea, and with the U.S. having their military ships do these provocative drive-bys challenging Chinese territorial claims of these islands. And with the reconnaissance planes, the spy planes going right up the Chinese border, and then the U.S. complaining about the conditions under which they were intercepted. Right. Tensions are pretty high right now.
Yeah. And let me ask you finally for looking at it is, I assume that there is a time limit on the window of opportunity for China to develop this blue water navy and in any event to grow a competitive regionally. Naval capacity. Are they up to it in terms of being able to produce this on time as against the, the push coming from the United States?
No, I don't think there really is a definite time limit to this. I think time is on China's side in this. The biggest problem is political balancing of their neighbors against them. But the U.S. Is really suffering from overstretch. Their navy is not able to meet the demands of countering Russia in the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea, countering China here, maintaining strong presence in the Mediterranean and in complete control of the Gulf. China, U.S.'s navy is really overstretched, and it's only going to get more so as China's and Russia's navy continue to evolve, and India becomes, is developing their own navy and will continue to play this wild card role, a balancing role. I think time is on China's side, and certainly distance. I mean, the U.S. is 5,000 to 6,000 miles away. As China's defense and offense capabilities develop, this area will be continually more denied access. This is the what terrifies U.S. generals. They're always concerned with anti-access area denial, A2AD. And with Chinese Navy and China getting a hold of Russia's powerful S-400 air defense, which is a big concern again for U.S. generals. And it really becomes a problem. I mean, China's official position is still one of peaceful rise. And they've defined six core interests, which are pretty nominal. I mean, with state sovereignty, national security, territorial integrity, China's development of their political system according to the Chinese constitution and overall social stability, basic safeguards for ensuring China's continuing sustainable economic and social development. None of these things are too crazy. But
it sounds almost like the UN Charter.
it doesn't sound that much. But again, territorial integrity. And the sixth one is Chinese national reunification. And it's there and with territorial integrity and exactly what China considers theirs in the South China Sea, this question of this nine-dash line, and of course the question of reunification with Taiwan and the ever-present threat of Taiwan declaring full independence from China and what role the U.S. would play in that. That is where the tension comes in. And while China is putting feelers out, along their supply lines, extending the Silk Road, the flashpoint is always going to be this conflict in the South China Sea as China seeks to break out of this U.S. cordon that they're trying to erect over it and exert control over their naval near abroad.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.